Greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Malin, joined by the entire MERS crew once again as we name our House Member of the Year for this particular podcast. We also have the retiring justice from the Supreme Court, Stephen Markman, is going to be joining us to answer some questions. And also, we're going to have a special poem that was shared to us by the Senate Majority Leader, Mike Shirky. This is kind of a takeoff on the night before Christmas. And as you can imagine, it does have a particular bent to it in terms of the businesses that have been impacted by the COVID response shutdowns. So we're going to go first to that and listen to this particular recording that was shared to us by the Senate Majority Leader.
The Grinch Who Stole Christmas from an Entire Family of Businesses. 'Twas the approaching of Christmas when all through the state there were visions of fond places where we all once ate. Our gatherings at places with disciplined care were once safe and compliant and open without fear. But increases in cases of this insidious virus's rapacity seem to test hospital system impatient capacity. Leaders who lead have a common desire when those that they lead seem under fire. But to act and to solve may seem quite logical, while watchful waiting seems hardly desirable. But acting too fast without restraint and good judgment may seem to be the safest, but lead to more problems. What's worse, our actions without full consult, where collateral damage beyond measure can result. That's precisely what's happened in a certain of our industries, where abusive restrictions have destroyed hoped future realities. Despite being safe by their own metrics and data, big government decided this was the target they were after. The cases and beds indeed began to decline, and many were lifted with hope and positive opine. But other clear actions and messages and such were also deployed with vigor and robust. The shutdowns were narrow and few industry-focused, yet the cost not considered, despite crisis in outcomes. Correlation for sure, along with many other key variables, but the causation unclear and to many quite dubious. The cost of lives and livelihoods continues to grow, and ignorance of statistics allows it to be so. Despite challenges and requests to prove actions worth, shutdowns are easy and to government seem proof. And then who knew that popcorn was so dangerous? We can now see a movie, but concessions are bad for us. Thankful that bowling can now be enjoyed, but don't think of a beer as our bowling balls we deploy. Stepping back for a review of historic decisions, it's hard to be surprised by the illogical actions. COVID is real and folks are properly reacting with care and awareness of their immediate surroundings. Could this be the cause of grateful decreases in cases, or are the shutdowns the source of the improved indications? We have good reference to support this assertion. People have listened and responded to consistent exhortation. But it's more easy and seems tough to act as in strength when reality and data support reasoned restraint. If one disregards the collateral costs, the high-handed orders seem confident and just. But woe unto those who use a one-sided ledger. There are two important sides we must surely consider. There's just as much evidence that causation can be traced to messaging and signaling and trust in citizens we placed. A choice to be made without politics we hoped, but apparently it's control that's a much higher goal. So the hurting and suffering continues to grow, disproportionate to good trends in case and hospital census growth. COVID will pass with new vaccines and treatments, but there are no inoculations to business closings. Lost life savings and more threaten lives and livelihoods, yet vaccines don't work well to cure rampant bankruptcies. Inform, inspire, and encourage with persistence and commitment are just as effective as closings and oppressive restrictions. If we trust in our people who have proven they know what to do, we can continue these trends, and away with COVID we go. There is but one obstacle to a more sensible direction. It's the Grinch that stole Christmas from an entire economic selection.
Okay, now we're going to move to our House Member of the Year. And again, to recap, this is the third installment of our Members of the Year. We nominated and awarded our Democratic Member of the Year last week. That was Sylvia Santana. And our Political Figure of the Year we awarded 2 weeks ago, and that was Governor Gretchen Whitmer. This week, we are doing House Member of the Year. And again, our criteria is impact, effectiveness, and a high level of activity. And so it's through that lens we are looking for who our particular House Member of the Year is. So to start our nominations, we're going to go with the boss, John Roerink.
Thanks, Cal. My nominee this year for House Member of the Year is Representative Matt Hall, Chair of the House Oversight Committee. And I pick him because oversight is such an important role for the legislature to play, and it's not always applied in a very firm or uniform fashion. Representative Hall has done a lot of work with this committee this year, looking at the UIA issues, looking into the election, holding the governor's feet to the fire in terms of the public health orders and how they've been working and how they've been applied and what their impact is. The only demerit I'd probably give him is having allowed Rudy Giuliani to present testimony. And I say that not from a partisan perspective, but only because I think it probably turned into too much of a circus. I think it diminished what Republicans could point to as an effort to find real reforms that could improve our electoral process and that could provide voter certainty had they been applied. So that was probably the only demerit I would give him. But certainly he has been a strong advocate for oversight. And for that reason alone, I think he certainly deserves to be nominated as House Member of the Year.
Okay, thanks, John. I like that nomination of Matt Hall. And I understand the argument that the Giuliani hearing turned into a bit of a circus. But I'm going to give him a pass on that because I think politics above his pay grade contributed to the reason for the hearing in the first place. The hearing itself, outside of the fact he gaveled Representative Cynthia Johnson down a bit too much, I think he did a good job as he could walking the tightrope between being fair while also being respectful to Rudy Giuliani and the other witnesses. He did put in a time limit. He held it. The meeting itself at 6 o'clock, so it wouldn't go on and on and on and on. In the end, I think he was as fair as could be expected in terms of extracting as much information as possible, looking to find flaws in the state's election system. And I know the Secretary of State sees it differently, and maybe we're going to need to see what comes out of this deep dive into Detroit and Livonia's elections before we know for sure. But overall, he was an active member. He did hold DHHS Director Robert Gordon and Steve Gray's feet to the fire for a good part of the year as part of his special COVID oversight task force. You know, from May to September, you're not going to find another committee that was as active as Matt Hall's. So when you look at the criteria again, you can't argue the level of impact component. So yeah, I agree. Good nomination, John. And now Mike Malott, our House reporter, why don't you go ahead and give your nomination for House Member of the Year.
For House Member of the Year, I would like to nominate Representative Graham Filler. He is a Republican from DeWitt, and the primary reason for my nomination is that he is the chairman of House Judiciary Committee, which I'm pretty certain is the most productive committee in the House of Representatives and likely the most productive in the entire legislature. The committee has put a high priority on criminal justice reforms and has been very productive in turning out packages in that regard. Last year, as you may recall, they sent out the Raise the Age package, in which they increased from 17 to 18 the age at which a youngster can be considered an adult for prosecution in the justice system when they get in trouble with the law. But that was last year. So what have they done this year? Well, this year, of course, they also had a package of bills that changed minor low-level misdemeanor charges into civil infractions. And I chuckle at some of the misdemeanors that were on the list. For example, you could get a 90-day sentence for failing to mark your tip-up with your name and address when you're ice fishing. You could get a 90-day sentence for going fishing and forgetting to take your license with you. You paid for the license and you have a license, but you forget to put it in your pocket when you go out to cast a line, and that's a 90-day misdemeanor under the old law. Seems a little harsh, and you might say that that's unlikely that somebody's going to spend jail time for such a low-level offense, but indeed, why have it on the books if that's the case? Now, there was one case where they had a young man who had bought a certificate for a snowmobile, and he couldn't put it on the front of his snowmobile, so he put it on the back. He had the certificate. He'd paid for the certificate, but because he had it on the back of the snowmobile instead of the front, it was a 90-day misdemeanor, and you say, well, that, no judge is going to enforce that, but he had to go back to Northern Michigan four times in order to get that cleared up, so that seems silly. So that's one package. Now, the other package that they had was expungement of low-level misdemeanors. In some cases, that's automatic. In some cases, you have to go before the judge. And related to that, but separate, they recently took up a package to get rid of, or not a package, it was a single bill, to get rid of first-time DUIs. The first time you have a DUI, you can call that an error in judgment. Second or third offense, and you got a drinking problem. If we're willing to expunge some low-level crimes, why not also DUIs if it's only a first offense and nobody was hurt? They took that up and sent that out. The Judiciary Committee has also dealt with protections for elders and senior citizens, from financial and physical abuse. And there were a number of other packages that the House Judiciary Committee has dealt with. One of the things I particularly like about House Judiciary is that these issues are not partisan issues. Representative Filler has worked very closely with the Democrats on that panel, in particular David LeGrand. And they both have really good and in-depth conversations on the potential ramifications of their bills. It's impressive to watch them turn a bill over for the various implications that it may have. And they really think it out, and they're not playing partisan games. They're doing their very best to come up with good policy, and a lot of good policy has come out of House Judiciary. That's why I want to nominate Representative Graham Filler as the House Member of the Year.
Well, that was very thorough, Mike. I appreciate that. Jacob Kanzler, why don't you go ahead and give your nomination?
Okay, so I'd like to nominate for House Member of the Year, Representative Mary Whiteford. Representative Whiteford serves as the chair of the Health and Human Services Appropriations Subcommittee and also serves on the Health Policy Committee. And so her bailiwick is kind of getting into the nuts and bolts of health policy, and she's been able to do that in a number of ways this year. One of her more recent efforts was to kind of help push through a reworked bill that would allow more nursing facilities be classified as care and recovery centers. So to kind of open up more options where COVID-19 positive patients could go outside of hospitals. She also has a bill on the way to the governor that will allow registered and licensed nurses from other states to practice in Michigan. And this is to help kind of combat the shortage of healthcare workers in Michigan. She also worked a lot on the psychiatric side of public health this year. She had some bills to improve crisis services for youths who are going through psychiatric emergency. And those bills are also on the way to the governor for a signature. And so In addition to those, I believe some bills we didn't mention, that she's got at least four other bills with her name on it as terms of public acts that she's gotten through this year, kind of contributing to her activity as well. She also recently was in the news for publicly coming out and defending Director Robert Gordon, or rather condemning the practice of people going to his home and protesting, you know, kind of standing up for someone that maybe she doesn't necessarily agree with on an ideological level, but at least kind of trying to draw the line in terms of decency and how people should be expressing themselves when they don't agree. So, you know, so for these reasons, in terms of her work on kind of the nuts and bolts and the wonkiness of health policy this year and getting results across in that arena, especially in the midst of COVID-19, I am nominating Representative Mary Whiteford as a House Member of the Year.
Thank you, Jacob. And Lisa Roos-Church, our court reporter, with our fourth nomination.
I'd like to nominate Representative Mike Mueller as House Member of the Year. I've covered the Courts or Crime beat for newspapers and now for MERS for years, and I appreciate and respect the demands law enforcement face on a day-to-day basis. As a representative, Mike Mueller played a critical role in many of the criminal justice reforms that were accomplished in 2020, which was a main bipartisan legislative accomplishment of the year. First, he served on the Joint Task Force on Jail and Pretrial Incarceration and was a leader among his class. While he has spent a career in law enforcement, Representative Mueller has also shown through his legislation that he is compassionate about those who find themselves on the wrong side of the law. He worked with Representative Yancey on passing through the House legislation to make driving on a suspended license a civil violation if the suspension didn't result in a serious driving offense. He was involved in the package that gives judges more discretion in sentencing. He also worked with Representative Filler on legislation to dial down low-level misdemeanors to civil infractions. However, he also remains a voice for victims, making sure that they're given rights when offenders have the opportunity to have their records expunged. When it was politically vague for conservative Republicans to call for the impeachment of Governor Gretchen Whitmer, Representative Mueller showed courage by publicly denouncing the tactic. It might have been politically advantageous for him to support the movement, but instead he said he would vote no if it were put on the voting board. Other work this session includes emergency COVID legislation that would stop food pickup services like Grubhub from taking advantage of the restaurants they deliver for. That bill is going to the governor and is expected to be signed. He also sponsored another bill to make sure drivers who couldn't renew their licenses on time due to COVID weren't hit with a late fee. Representative Mueller also worked across the aisle with Representative John Cherry on a series of bills designed to clean up abandoned mobile home parks and create some protections for those who live there. And I believe those bills will return in 2021. And before COVID sucked the oxygen out of the room legislatively, Representative Mueller was working on bills with Senator Ken Horn to get locals a larger cut of state transportation dollars. And finally, Representative Mueller was named co-chair on the Committees on Committees, which is a sign that he's earned the trust and respect of incoming Speaker Jason Wentworth. It is for these reasons that I nominate Representative Mike Mueller as House Member of the Year.
All right. Well, thank you for that, Lisa. You know, last week I mentioned how Senator Mallory McMorrow suggested that we look beyond the passage of bills when we consider these awards, and I'm going to take that to heart with my nomination. After the Midland area dam floods, the village of Sanford was completely devastated. One legislator poured her heart and soul into helping the residents get their lives back together, and that was Representative Annette Glenn. I spoke with Sanford Village President Dolores Port last week, and she told me that Annette Glenn was talking with her, texting with her at all hours, 7 days a week, to assist that village with grant funding, supplies. She was even doing the manual labor of pulling drenched drywall out of houses. She told me that Glenn, quote, went the extra mile in being a tireless public servant. Now, Port worked within the administration for Dow Chemical for 38 years. So she's worked with some very talented people. And she said Glenn, quote, definitely falls into that category. She told me that she would be 110% behind MERS nominating Glenn for House Member of the Year because she went above and beyond in not only just getting dollars, but also the manpower and equipment and getting her town on the road to recovery. I spoke with another source who told me that two different doctors on two separate occasions told him that Glenn's action literally saved people's lives. One House member also told me, quote, she put everything on the line in helping her community. But more than that, she's supportive of other House members impacted by COVID and other health struggles. She's one of the few House Republicans who I saw wear a mask 100% of the time. She continues to take social distancing seriously by sitting up in the gallery and not being in the House floor, which is arguably a petri dish. So I wondered if this was anecdotal, what she did in Sanford. And so what I did is I took a look at how Annette Glenn did in this past election. Is it just the leaders in Sanford who think she did a good job, or is it the residents of Sanford who also felt like she did a good job? So what I did is I looked at her election results in 2020 in Jerome Township, which is where Sanford is located, and I compared that to how she did in the year 2000 in the same exact precinct. So this is what I found. In just this area, Glenn went from winning by 300 votes to winning by 2-1. She picked up 500 votes in this tiny township, while Schultz, Sarah Schultz, her opponent, picked up 37. That's more than just incumbency strength. Outside of snagging $6 million from the state for cleanup efforts, she worked with Pam Hornberger on the COVID education package. She had a PA and a PA for legislation of greater oversight on IT project costs. But it's her hands-on work with Sanford, doing things like pulling soaked drywall out of homes, that rises Glenn's name to the top. And that's why I'm nominating her for House Member of the Year. Now, before we name our House Member of the Year, I would like to give some special recognition to a couple other members. First of all, I would say that Jason Wentworth has had a phenomenal year as far as the campaign front. I know this is more of a policy award, but on the campaign front, Jason Wentworth's ability to pull together the team and all row in the same direction, help the Republicans get to that 58-seat majority that they enjoy right now. So he certainly deserves some recognition there. And finally, it needs to be mentioned that Lee Chatfield leads office as one of the best House caucus leaders in at least the last 20 years. That's about as far back as I go. His ability to maintain caucus discipline is remarkable. His ability to raise money is remarkable. And his ability to get things that he wants to get through the chamber is also remarkable. He came into office a conservative ideologue and leaves office as someone who has learned to play the game as well as anyone. He's a winner, he's relentless, and someone who deserves the accolades he's been given. And with that, a special recognition then to the Speaker of the House, Lee Chatfield. And then the last thing I just want to say, Andrea Schroeder, the state representative out of Waterford, deserves to be mentioned just for her ability to be there. I mean, to be recovering from cancer, not being well physically, but continuously showing up on the House floor, even if it's probably not the best idea for her, pushing the button, representing her district. We can only imagine how difficult this has to be physically and how demanding it is. And to see her on the House floor under such circumstances is very admirable. So a special recognition to Andrea Schroeder as well. This year was a very hard choice. Criminal justice reform was the year's most significant legislative accomplishment. An amazing amount of time and effort went into changing the trajectory of how we treat people who have screwed up in their lives but need a second chance to become successful members of the society. But without question, the story of the year was COVID-19, and the Republicans' lead in holding the administration's feet to the fire was Matt Hall. Hall was already the chair of the House Oversight Committee, but took on the dual role as co-chair of the Joint Select Committee on the COVID-19 pandemic. Now, let's think about the impact of both committees. The three largest mistakes, arguably, the Whitmer administration made in its COVID response was its unemployment agency being caught completely flat-footed by the shutdowns, the early decision to put COVID-positive patients in nursing homes to recover, and the initial contact tracing contract going to a company with ties to the Democratic Party. On all of these subjects, Hall drilled down to get answers to these decisions. He raised questions as to whether Steve Gray was the right person for the job at that point in time. His research found Gray put concerns about fraud from those applying for benefits to the back burner. And as it turned out, Gray is no longer the head of the unemployment agency. On the nursing home front, Senator Pete Lucido and others joined the cavalcade of Republicans barking about the ways DHHS could make the treatment of COVID patients better. But again, it was Hall's committee that brought in the director, asked the tough questions, and became the channel for the Republicans' grievances against an administration that was, to be fair, making very hard decisions on the fly. On contact tracing, I'm not sure that new ground was broken from Hall's questioning, but it did put the administration on high alert that the Republicans were watching what was going on and that future attempts to pass contracts to political allies was not going to fly. Along the way, he earned respect from his colleagues as being tough, but not overly partisan. On the Giuliani hearing, I would mention that once he regained control of the committee, he did a fair job in asking questions and certainly did not endorse Giuliani's wild claims, but allowed his own members to question the witnesses' testimonies. I would have personally liked to have seen him bring in Secretary of State Jocelyn Benson to talk to her about the election efforts. I know that she felt it was going to turn into another political circus if she showed up, and maybe it would have. But he gets points from me for at least trying to bring her in. He earned respect from his Republican colleagues, whether they believed Trump's unsubstantiated claims of election fraud or not. COVID-19 was the story of the year. Matt Hall was the face of the Republicans' response. Nobody held more hearings. They were effective in drawing out issues and had impact. So for all of those reasons, we are going to name Representative Matt Hall the MERS House Member of the Year. Okay, we're going to move on now to our interview with Justice Stephen Markman. Now, I just want to alert our listeners that there was some controversy about a resolution in the Senate on Friday night that dealt with the accomplishments or lionizing the accomplishments of Stephen Markman, which were debated heavily on the Senate floor. Our interview with Stephen Markman happened prior to that resolution being debated on the floor. So the reason this doesn't come up in this interview is because it hadn't happened yet, and I didn't know there was going to be a big to-do about it, or else I would have brought it up. Also, I asked him a question here about the justices getting a pay raise. Also, that happened on the Senate session after our interview. So while we ask him about whether the raises should go through, and he does answer that, just keep in mind that the raises did indeed go through after our interview and that they will take effect in 2023 because of a constitutional timing issue. And it won't let them go into effect on 2021. So with that, here's our interview with the retiring Justice Stephen Markman. Join us here at MERS World Headquarters is the Justice of the Supreme Court, former Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, Stephen Markman. Thanks for joining us on the podcast today.
Thanks for inviting me this morning. I appreciate it much.
We're nearing the end of your tenure as a justice, former Chief Justice. Is it sinking in that you're almost done? I mean, it's got to be kind of weird, isn't it?
Yeah, I've been coming in most mornings for the last 21 years, so it is going to be very dislocating deciding how to organize my day in the next couple of weeks and months.
So what do you think your legacy is going to be on the Supreme Court?
Well, I wouldn't characterize it as a personal legacy, but I do think that the court, certainly over the first decade in which I was sitting on there, really had a very distinctive judicial point of view, a very distinctive sense of jurisprudence. And I'm proud to have participated in that, and I'm proud of its legacy. I think it was a legacy in which the law was generally made more clear, The law of the Supreme Court was generally rendered more in accordance with the statutory law of our state, which, of course, I think is the great mission of a court, to render its case law as consistent as possible with the statutory law of the land. And I think generally the law was made more predictable, more stable, and that's reflected at least in some part by the fact that numbers of cases and controversies coming before the court diminished somewhat during that period of time.
And what would you say about the second half of your term? So you mentioned kind of that's what happened the first kind of half. What about the second half?
Well, I think the philosophical orientation of the court has certainly changed during that time. The justices on the court continue to be conscientious and hardworking, but I do find myself being in dissent far more often than I was during the first half of my tenure. So I guess in that regard, I kind of think back to my old colleague Mike Kavanaugh, who experienced a similar reorientation during the course of his career on the bench, and it's instructive and educational, and certainly the ebb and flow of this kind of thing is not at all surprising, but I do find myself far more often in dissent than I used to be, but that's not a reflection on the majority, except that they increasingly have a different point of view than I do, but we found enough areas in which we can join together that I've continued to enjoy my tenure on the court and to enjoy my collegiality with my colleagues, but there is a different philosophical orientation, and I don't think any one of my colleagues would seriously disagree with that.
How would you say, you mentioned collegiality, how is the collegiality of this current court different from the one prior? Because from the outside, it would seem like the ones from the aughts, it was very tense, whereas this one is not as much. That's from the outside. What's your view on the inside?
Well, I don't know that I completely agree with that, Kyle. I'm certainly aware that there was that public sense that somehow the collegiality, you know, in past years hasn't always been ideal. I don't remember it exactly that way, with the exception of our relationships with one of our colleagues, a very difficult relationship. But I felt like I got along with my colleagues, such as Justice Marilyn Kelly and Justice Kavanaugh, with whom I didn't entirely agree philosophically, and they didn't entirely agree philosophically with me. So I don't think that there was any less collegial court, with, you know, one exception.
Maybe Betty Weaver?
Well, I'll leave people to speculate about who that would have been, if you don't mind.
John?
Justice, I was going to ask you, if you had been allowed to under the law, would you have run again?
That's a good question. I guess I didn't have to give consideration to that, since I knew as far back as 2012 that if I prevailed in that election, it was going to be my last election, and it's a lot easier to accommodate yourself to that kind of thing when you know it's there and you know it's not likely to be changed. And in fact, we had a case coming before our court dealing with precisely that issue in the context of one of the members of the Court of Appeals, and I sustained the statute that was at issue concerning age limits for members of the court. So I don't think it's an unreasonable thing for the people to want to have an age limit. That's not to say that everybody who confronts that age limit who runs up against that age limit is necessarily someone who can't continue to perform at a reasonable level on the court. But age being what it is, I think the people are entitled to their own sense of judgment as to how to handle these things, and they've done that by their constitution, and issue is not whether I agree with what they've done in any particular constitutional regard, but simply have they exercised representative government as they've seen fit to do, and they have seen fit to do it.
Yeah, you might have answered my second question. I was going to ask you your thoughts about justices running. Would we be better off if they were appointed? Have you given much thought to that?
I gave a great deal of thought to that, particularly when I was ensconced in the elections. I remember when I was at the beginning of my judicial career, I ran almost statewide for the Court of Appeals. We were in the district that covered, you know, 60 of the 83 counties in Michigan, or maybe it was 61 or 62 of those counties at the time. and I ran in 96 and 98 and 2000 and 2004. So I certainly had a fair amount of time to think about that. I don't know that the state system is better or worse than the federal system. I think they both have their strengths, but they both have their weaknesses too. Concerning the strengths, obviously the strength of the federal system is I think people are less inclined to suggest that there's a lack of independence on the part of the judiciary because sometimes they have people in their courtroom who might have contributed to their campaigns or contributed to their opponents' campaigns. I understand the appearance problem there, but if you're going to have a system in which you can raise money for judicial campaigns so that you can articulate to 10 million people why it is that they ought to consider voting for you as opposed to your opponent, the only way you can do that is to provide some kind of resources for that. And the way we provide those resources is by trying to raise funds and spending them in the course of our campaigns. The strength of the state system, though, is that you do have to campaign, and you do have to be accountable to the people, and you do have to go to 100 or 200 events and occasions and try to explain to the people what the differences are between you and the individual who's running against you, and explain the judicial system, and explain the debate that's occurring within the judicial system, and that's something you don't have to do if you're on the federal court. You can conduct yourself in a far more monastic way if you're on the federal court than if you're on the state bench. And I don't know that's an entirely ideal system either, particularly when judges generally and federal judges particularly have garnered so much power in recent years. I don't know that lifetime tenure is something that would have been a matter of the same kind of consensus support in the year 2020, given the power of the federal judiciary compared to the nature of that power 200 and some years ago.
As far as other judicial reform, I wanted to ask you about pay, because the SOC Commission had suggested that the pay for Supreme Court justices be raised, because we're getting to the point where Court of Appeals judges are going to be making the same, if not more, than Supreme Court justices. How do you make that appeal to the legislature that this has to get done if you do believe that it does have to get done?
Well, I think you're asking the wrong person, because I did make that appeal to both the Speaker of the House's office and the Senate Majority Leader when I was the Chief Justice. And you can see how effective I must have been by the fact that the pay was not increased during that period of time. But I think it's a serious problem. I understand the people's general concern with more pay for public officials, not at all unconcerned myself about that in certain contexts, but the idea that we're going to have lower court judges making more money than the Supreme Court because their pay is determined in a different manner is something of great concern to me. Some point in the very near future, I hope very, very soon, although it's certainly going to be of no effect on me, I think that there ought to be some serious consideration to what's happening concerning pay on the highest court of the state, where there hasn't been a pay increase for, I think it's 19 years going on 20. That is a problem, and I know for certain that there have been colleagues of mine who've left the court as a function of concern about the pay of the Supreme Court. That's not an argument for increasing that pay, but it's simply something that ought to be recognized, that for nearly 20 years, this court has not gotten even a cost of living increase. I think there's something that should be done to correct that situation, especially with the Court of Appeals imminently is going to be making more money than our court.
During your career as justice, I'm wondering if there's one issue that you, if you could, that you would have the legislature fix or address. It could be relating to anything. It could be related to judiciary. It could be relating to structure of the relationship between the three branches. Is there one thing you think they should have as their top priority?
I've always felt very strongly that sentencing guidelines were probably the most successful reform in both the federal and the state systems in recent decades. I had the opportunity to work on the federal sentencing guidelines when I was with the Senate Judiciary Committee, And I remember the nature of the coalition in favor of federal sentencing reform. You had Senator Thurmond and Senator Hatch on one side, and you had Senator Biden and Senator Kennedy on the other side. It couldn't have been a broader coalition. And I think it produced sentencing guidelines that went a very, very long way toward ensuring that when people were convicted of federal criminal activities, their sentences would not be determined on the basis of whether or not maximum Mike or lenient Larry was the judge in those cases, but on the basis of the law. And I think the state sentencing guidelines have contributed similarly to a rationalization of the criminal sentencing law in our state. Our court struck the guidelines down several years on the basis of their conclusion that they were unconstitutional. I didn't agree with that, but I certainly didn't think it was an outrageous conclusion or an unreasonable conclusion on the part of my colleagues. I didn't agree with that, but I guess I really had hoped by this point that the legislature would have looked at the sentencing guidelines and the contribution of the sentencing guidelines to making our system more rational and more fair, and try to come up with an alternative that would have retained the value and the benefit of a guideline structure while addressing the constitutional concerns that my colleagues on the court identified.
With the current makeup of the court, you mentioned earlier that you found yourself in the minority more than you had prior. With that being kind of a change in role for you, what do you kind of feel like has been your role this last few terms on the Supreme Court?
Well, there have been many cases in which there's been a consensus that's crossed unorthodox lines on the court, or indeed it's crossed all lines on the court. So I don't want to suggest that it's an impenetrable situation in which, you know, one coalition doesn't overlap with another coalition. That happens all the time. I think there's some value. Dissents essentially are judges in courts speaking to a future generation, and I've looked upon it that way. When I write my dissents, I try to write them respectfully toward the majority, but I try to write them clearly and strongly and sufficiently responsibly, I hope, so that future generations of justices on the court might take a second look at my statements and perhaps at some future time adopt them. I've tried to be consistent. I mean, there's been nothing more important to me than being consistent in my decision making, because to me that's really the essence of the rule of law. If you don't adopt and apply your standards and your principles and your approaches to giving meaning to the law in a consistent, compatible manner, I don't really think that the rule of law is being affected very well. So I've looked upon my dissents as being a cry in the wilderness to my future colleagues to be, and I hope at least some of them will give some thought to it.
What are your concerns and what are your hopes for the future Supreme Court as Elizabeth Welch comes in and the Democratic nominated justices have a majority? What are your concerns and maybe hopes for the next Supreme Court?
Well, that's a good question. It's also a hard question. I don't know Justice-elect Welch. I mean, I've heard very good things about her, and I know she'll be working hard, and she'll be incorporated, I hope, before very long into the culture of the court, which I think is generally a good culture in which all of my colleagues are working hard, they're conscientious, they're trying to do the right thing by their own philosophical lights, and they're trying to get along with their six colleagues. So I expect, and I'm quite certain that Justice-elect Welch will fit into that institution. I guess I'm just concerned that the great contributions that I see the court having made over time, in terms of the predictability of the law, in terms of the stability of the law, in terms of lawyers being able to tell their counsel, their clients, that it's likely that if a particular statute is going to be interpreted by the court, it'll be interpreted this way because this is what the law says, and because they assume the court will interpret the law as it says. I hope that'll be the case. I hope it'll continue to be the case. And I hope not only that we'll continue to give reasonable meaning to the language of the law, but maybe even more than that, I think the first responsibility of this court, as it is for government generally, for the legislature, for the executive, for all of our institutions, state and local, is to make sure that we have a strong criminal justice system. If you don't have a strong criminal justice system, you're not going to be strong in most other respects. If a community can't minimize violent crime and address in an effective manner criminal predators and those who prey upon the community, I don't think you can have a strong community, and I don't think you can have a community that's prosperous and free and in which people can live up to their greatest potential. I hope more than anything else that the court will recognize that our first function, just like it is the first function of government generally, is to maintain a fair and just criminal justice system. And I hope the court can in fact maintain that over time.
Justice Stephen Markman, thank you so much for the time today and talking about your time on the Supreme Court.
Thank you, Kyle. Thank you, John. I appreciate it.
And that's going to do it for this week's edition of the MERS Monday podcast. We'd like to thank AT&T for sponsoring this and all our other podcasts. Justice Stephen Markman for taking time and speaking with us. Senate Majority Leader Mike Shirky was sharing his on the night before Christmas rendition with us. And also the entire crew at MERS for their contributions to the House Member of the Year deliberations. Until next week, I'm Kyle Malin. Take care.